It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In 2011, the Associated Press began releasing a series of reports that the New York Police Department was indiscriminately spying on Muslims in New York City.
Those reports led to anger within the Muslim community and conversations about government surveillance around the country.
The two investigative reporters who worked on that story, Matt Aputo and Adam Goldman, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2012 for their investigations. Now they've co-authored a book detailing the NYPD's surveillance and what it ultimately achieved. It's called Enemies Within, Inside the NYPD's Secret Spying Unit and Bin Laden's Final Plot Against America. Adam Goldman joins us now. Adam, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So when did the NYPD begin spying on the Muslim community in New York?
Well, shortly after 9/11, Ray Kelly decided he needed to revamp what is known as the NYPD Intelligence Division. And it's a division within the NYPD. It had mainly been used to protect dignitaries of glorified chauffeur service. So Ray Kelly decided New York could no longer depend on the federal government to keep the city safe, and he began bolstering their counterterrorism programs. There were a number of programs he created in 2003, including a demographics unit, which involves plainclothes officers going out in the community and basically raking it and mapping the human terrain.
And this is unusual, I would think, for municipalities and states around the country to try to set up an intelligence operation like the FBI does on a national level, like the CIA does on an international level.
Yeah, this is highly unusual. We didn't find anything close to it in the United States. There was a proposal in L.A., but then Chief Bratton, when the community found out about it, Bratton scrapped the program. They were going to map their Muslims, too. But it's also a product of the NYPD being an enormous police force. It's 35,000 police officers, $2 billion budget. It's huge, and it has the resources to deploy officers to engage in these types of operations and develop informants to do it as well.
What were some of the first signs that tipped you and your co-author off to the existence of this program?
Well, we started, Matt and I covered national security in Washington, D.C., CIA, FBI, and we started hearing terms we were unfamiliar with, rakers, demographics unit, and moss crawlers. And it was our curiosity that led us to figure out what those terms meant. And like I said before, the NYPD had created a demographics unit, and it employed plainclothes officers of Southeast Asian Arab descent who went out into the communities and raked the communities. And the idea was if you rake the embers and you rake the coals, and if you rake them, you might find a smoking ember. And that smoking ember could be a sign of radicalization, maybe a Muslim who was going down the wrong path, and they would be able to preempt any terror attack.
One of the first operations you describe in the book, I think it was maybe before the demographics unit or around the same time, actually crossing the borders, going outside of New York State and getting exposed when an empty surveillance room was discovered by a landlord. Can you talk through that story?
Yeah, this was actually in 2009. The NYPD has said it'll go anywhere and do anything it wants, essentially, in the United States. And they had set up a operation in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which is where Rutgers is located. And they are using a safe house to spy on the Muslim Student Association at Rutgers. Of course, the NYPD broke the first rule of running a safe house, which is you can never leave it unmanned. Because a building superintendent knocked on the door, he was doing a check, and he came in and he found all sorts of Al-Qaeda literature and radios. He thought this was an actual terrorist cell. Of course, it was a police operation, and so he called the FBI and they raided the apartment, not knowing what it was. It was very embarrassing for the NYPD.
So, how did the FBI feel about this unit in New York City that thought it could go anywhere to do the job that the FBI, in theory, was already doing?
Well, under a presidential executive order, 12333, the FBI is responsible for domestic terrorism in the United States. And within municipalities across the country, there's something called the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And on the JTTF is the CIA, NSA, and all local police departments. So the idea is that everybody's working together, right, to thwart terrorism, and everybody knows what everybody's doing. But the intelligence division, under the leadership of a guy named Dave Cohen, who came from the CIA, said, "Well, you know what? That's your model, and we're not gonna adhere to that model." And he believed that, you know, you should, but both the JTTF and the Intel should do their own separate investigations. And the problem with doing that is many times you end up having parallel investigations. So they bump into each other, and they can cause serious problems. But the other problem is, you know, the local police, they don't have, you know, they can't get secret FISA warrants. They can't, you know, tape calls, you know, out of the country. They're just things they can't do because they don't have federal powers. And when they drop these cases on the FBI at the 11th hour, you know, because the FBI is not involved in them, there's only so much they can do. And for instance, there was a case involved a guy by the name of Hamid Abdel Shahada, and the NYPD had been watching him, but they never told the FBI until the very last minute when he was on a plane to go to Pakistan to engage in violent jihad. So the FBI had to scramble, cause an international incident with the Pakistanis, and, you know, they managed to get him turned around, but they didn't have a case against him. He was eventually convicted for lying, but from the way the FBI saw it, they could have gotten a much stronger, if they had just worked together, they could have come up with a much stronger case.
Can you talk about the background of the people who started this unit and who made the case that New York needed its own counterterrorism intelligence operation?
Well, Ray Kelly was certainly front and center. He had been there at the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, and so Ray said, "We're gonna revamp this intelligence division." So he reached out and he tapped a guy by the name of Dave Cohen, and Dave Cohen was a career analyst at the CIA. Decades there, and he rose to the top of the CIA and ended up running what's known as their clandestine arm. He was essentially their top spy and was in charge of all spying operations worldwide. And so he had gone to New York, and he was working for AIG, and Ray said, "Do you want to come and run this intelligence division?" And so Dave took the job, and he went out, and he asked for help. And George Tenet, who was then the director of the CIA, loaned him a guy by the name of Larry Sanchez, who was another career CIA analyst. But the problem with Sanchez was there really wasn't a memorandum of understanding what he was supposed to be doing. So he started off his day at the CIA station in New York, and he'd go over to, you know, police headquarters, and there was a real blurring of the line. But it was really these two individuals who dreamed up many of these programs.
Before we get into more of the specifics of what actually was going on, were there cases where this crossed the line from maybe unconventional into illegal?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. Right now, it's before a judge. What I can tell you is the NYPD Intelligence Division operates under a consent decree. And that's because in the 60s and 70s, the NYPD was spying on political activists, anti-war protesters, gay rights and the gay rights movement, and they sued. And in 1985, they decided to settle with the police department. So it put put restrictions on what kind of on First Amendment protected activity, you know, political or religious activity that they, you know, they're that if they wanted to open, if the NYPD wanted to open a case based on First Amendment activity, political or religious activity, you know, it had to go through this Hanshew committee. But after 9/11, Cohen managed to get the judge in the case to basically scrap this committee, and instead of having evidence of a crime to open an investigation, now it was just a mere possibility. So really from there, they were able to conduct these operations. If there's one thing that could come back and bite the NYPD is that under this consent decree, the judge said, "Look, you're the NYPD. You can go anywhere the public can go. You can go into these restaurants. You can go on the mosque. You can go to these places. You can go to these websites. But you can't, unless there's criminal activity, you can't put that information in secret police files." So they spent an enormous amount of time going to these places and websites and writing things down, eavesdropping on conversations, counting Qurans, all sorts of things, and then putting them in police secret police files. So it's, you know, the judge heard oral arguments in the case recently, so we might know something in a few months.
We're talking to Adam Goldman. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter with the Associated Press, co-author of the new book, Enemies Within, Inside the NYPD's Secret Spying Unit and Bin Laden's Final Plot Against America.
You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time.
We'll pick up now with Adam Goldman, one of the investigative reporters who cover the NYPD's spying unit designed to spy on Muslims in New York City, talking about his new book. He's the co-author, Enemies Within. Adam, one of the more controversial things that came out in your reports were how widespread the targeting, the surveillance of Muslims in New York was. Can you talk about the scope, the demographics unit and beyond?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was massive. They set out to literally map the Muslim human terrain of New York City. So they wanted to get it. They went into, you know, hundreds of mosques. They decided which ones were of concern. It was literally a mosque of concern. There were dozens of mosques of concern. They profiled Egyptian, Syrian, Albanian, the Moroccan communities. They went into their restaurants. They went into their mosques. They went into their hookah joints. They went into their cafes, and they took pictures of these establishments, and they put them in secret police files. They mounted what is called a terrorism enterprise investigation. And basically, they would say, they would come up with an investigative statement and say, you know, we believe we need to open a terrorism enterprise case against a mosque, which is similar to saying it's like a RICO case with a mob. You know, if the mob is using a facility, you know, there's only one purpose of the facility. It's for criminal activity because the mob's a criminal enterprise. So they're making the same argument against some of these mosques. And it was quite extraordinary. They would label the mosque a terrorism enterprise and begin investigating them. And anybody who went into the mosque was subject to the investigation. So they would put license plate recorders out, and they would put video cameras out in front of the mosque. They would use pole cameras, and they would keep an eye on the mosque. They would send informants and undercovers in with listening devices in their watches and their key fobs. They would record sermons, and it didn't matter what the sermon said. They were putting it in secret police files. For instance, there was a New York pitcher named Corey Lydell who crashed his plane into a building. Within hours, the FBI announced that it wasn't terrorism. But that didn't matter to the NYPD. They sent their informants into the mosque, and they tape recorded what these imams were saying, even though it had nothing to do with terrorist activity. They were just saying, "Oh man, my God, I'm so glad it's not terrorism. We're glad it's not terrorism." And that ended up in secret police files. This is an actual example. There were two guys who were talking about the Bush State of the Union address, and because they were talking about it in Urdu, that ended up in a police file because Urdu is a language of concern to the NYPD. So it was extensive, and it still is.
What was the reaction from Muslim communities in New York when this information started to come out?
Well, they were outraged. They felt violated. Many had suspected this was going on. There had been a court case in 2004 that stretched to 2006 in which, you know, glimpses of this dripped out, but not in the detail that we published. But they were not only the outrage, they were frustrated because they couldn't get anybody in New York to listen to them. You know, Ray Kelly was unapologetic, Bloomberg was unapologetic, and they said they were going to keep doing this. There were polls done in New York where New Yorkers basically just said, "Yeah, this is great. Spy on them." So there wasn't much recourse for them, and they felt violated. And of course, there were other Muslims who didn't want to cause any problems. I remember Matt went and talked to a Moroccan. He said, "Look, I don't want any trouble. I don't want any trouble." He was in one of these secret police files. His business. It was a known Moroccan barbershop, whatever that is. And he said, "I don't want any trouble." He's like, "If I'm not doing anything, then I don't have anything to worry about." And he said, "Look, in Morocco, they would just come and take me away." So many of these people were U.S. citizens, and eventually they did mobilize and started a grassroots campaign, and they started registering voters, and they made themselves heard much more than they had in the past in New York. And You know, there are 700,000-800,000 Muslims in New York City, so it's not an insignificant community. But many are, you know, first and second, and they're now sort of figuring out, listen, you only have clout if you vote.
Were there any success stories from the New York Police Department's counterterrorism program?
Well, the one they point to involves a couple of guys who had serious mental issues who decided they wanted to blow up what's known as the Herald Square subway stop in New York, and it started on. They were arrested in 2004, and they were eventually convicted, and that was upheld. There were some people who say, well, it took a year and $100,000 before these guys actually decided they wanted to do anything. They never actually made a bomb. Our book is actually a thriller. When we write about a case involving a young man named Najib Elazazi and his two buddies who were from Flushing, Queens. And they actually go off to Pakistan and get trained by Al-Qaeda and decide to come back and blow up the New York City subways. They get caught by the NSA and FBI, and they're in prison now. But, you know, we use that as an instructive example because the NYPD was in their mosque, they were in their travel agency, they were in their restaurants, they were in their YMCA, they were in the Muslim Student Association, and they missed these guys at every level. And it was a most serious terrorist plot since 9/11.
How did they miss them if they were in the midst of this intelligence gathering operation and they were that close to them?
That's a good question. They were right under their nose. I think one you could argue that they... that the more serious the guys who really are bent on doing damage, and this came out in trial, that they realized, like, you don't talk about wanting to blow things up in the mosque, and you don't talk about these things in public, and you don't associate with people you want to know, and these are the hardest people to detect. So this, you know, this idea of going out and collecting information on the community, you know, which is reminiscent of what police states have done, doesn't necessarily keep you safer.
I want to
get lost in the information.
I want to spend the last couple of minutes talking about what's happened since your reports and since your book came out. What has changed, as far as we know, in the New York City Police Department when it comes to counterterrorism?
Well, there is no longer the NYPD no longer has a CIA officer embedded in the intelligence division. We have been writing about that, and then Director of the CIA, General Petraeus, ended that relationship. He pulled this guy out, this clandestine operative, and decided, you know, enough was enough. Congress also weighed in and thought it was inappropriate. Congress didn't know the extent of what was going on, didn't know the extent of this relationship. And in the wake of our reporting and also some of the stop and frisk movement that was going on here, the outrage towards stop and frisk from the African American and Latino community, the city council passed an IG, an inspector general bill, for the first time in the department's history. There will be an inspector general with subpoena power at the NYPD, and they also passed a racial profiling bill.
And the reaction,
outlawing racial profiling.
And the reaction from the people who started this program, were they repentant and apologetic, or did they stand by the program
no,
they'd initiated?
They stand by it, and Bloomberg and Kelly are unapologetic, and they think they're doing what's necessary to keep the city safe. And they're not going to apologize for that. There were other people who are in our book. The person who led the demographics unit decided to go public and talk about what was going on, and he felt it was a waste of time. Much of what they were doing was simply a waste of time, and they weren't making New York safer. And these are good guys. These are good NYPD detectives who put murderers and drug dealers in jail, right? They took guns off the street, you know. That makes the city safe. And they didn't understand why they were spending so much time just spying on people and collecting information.
Was there a sense that this was a big resource suck that would have been better spent elsewhere?
Yeah, there was a sense of that. And you could look at several. Look, nobody's arguing the NYPD shouldn't be out there, you know, doing terrorists. It's the way we go about doing it, right? You mean, there's a balance with civil liberties. And nobody disputes there's a threat. There is a threat, and that's undeniable. But why are you engaging in these programs? And under testimony, the commanding officer of the intelligence division last summer had to admit that that the previous summer before that, had to admit that the demographics unit never generated a terrorism tip, right? And, you know, they have these guys, these NYPD detectives overseas, but they're not embedded in the embassy. They're not associated with the embassy. They're just there on tourist visas, you know, talking to local police departments. But they've never generated a terrorism lead. You know, that program itself cost them $1 million. So, but it's all part of Kelly's, you know, look what we're doing. And he touts these things. But if it's not working, then why waste the money on that?
We'll leave it there. Adam, thanks for joining us today.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
That's Adam Goldman. He's co-author of Enemies Within, Inside the NYPD's Secret Spying Unit, and Bin Laden's Final Plot Against America.
Coming up next, the news, and then we'll be back to talk about smoking and the idea of banning cigarette sales for people under 21.
This is Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll talk with a guest who says we the people, us, well, we're actually capable of ending gridlock in Washington.
But first, smokers younger than 21 in the nation's biggest city will soon be barred from buying cigarettes. Yesterday, the New York City Council voted overwhelmingly to raise the tobacco purchasing age.
That got us thinking, would something like this make sense here in Wisconsin, or is 18 the right legal limit to make tobacco purchases? You can join us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea? You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Joining us now is Donna Wininski, Policy Director at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin. Donna, thanks so much for joining us today.
And thanks for inviting me. Happy Halloween, gentlemen.
Ooh, happy Halloween back to you. We're going to get to your reaction on some of the New York City legislation in just a few minutes, but I'd like kind of like to start with some background about what's happening here in Wisconsin right now. As I understand it, the age to buy tobacco is 18 in Wisconsin?
That's correct.
And what does the teen smoking rate in the state look like right now?
The smoking rate, the latest figures that we have, is in high school they're smoking at right around 14, a little bit under 14%, and the middle school rate is 2.5%. Now, that having been said, what we are finding that's a little more alarming is that for the first time, teens are starting to smoke little cigars in a greater abundance than cigarettes. So while the cigarette smoking rate is going down, we're starting to see more and more teens pick up the little cigar habit.
So that 14% rate you mentioned is different than the cigar habit? It's not tied in with that?
The way the survey is worded, it said smoked a cigarette. So technically, yes, that is cigarette smoking rate. And they're right about even now, according to Department of Health Services figures, or another tenth or 0.2% higher for the cigars. So we don't want to be seeing kids just switching products. What we want to be seeing them doing is actually not starting them, or if they have experimented with it, with quitting.
And overall trends, as you look back over the last, say, 5 or 10 years, what has that looked like? Has that been going down? Have we plateaued? Where are we on that?
Well, with youth smoking, we've certainly been going down. If you look at the last 10 years, high school smoking rates at one point in time were well over 30%, and so they've been cut more than half by now. The adult rate also has trended down, but that's become a little bit more stable. We're hovering right around the 20% rate for adult smoking.
Now, as I understand it, New York City will be the first major city to pass a bill like this, but I know there are some other smaller towns, I think mostly on the East Coast, that have also passed legislation like this already?
I wouldn't be able to name them for you, but I do believe you're correct. I do know of some other states that have raised their tobacco purchase price to age 19. Alabama, Alaska, New Jersey, Utah, they have at least raised it to 19, and I believe the reason for that is they're trying to get it out of the high schools. Most kids are finished with high school by the time they're 18, so that by raising the age to 19, they can at least prevent the seniors from buying it for the lower classmen.
So moving to New York right now, the vote there in the city council, apparently pretty overwhelming. It sounds as though the mayor is planning to sign it, and your reaction is it's going to help? This is something you're in favor of?
Well, as a national organization, yes, we're in favor of it. There is some evidence that youth smoking rates can be brought down by raising the age to 21. There's some data that shows that age group between 18 and 21 is still a very experimental period in young people's lives. They've graduated from high school. They've either gone away to college. It might be the first time that they're away from their parents and their community and support system. They might be out in the workforce in their first apartment. So it is still a very vulnerable period in their lives where they're experimenting and trying new things. So some of the logic behind raising it to 21 is that puts it kind of on the same par as alcohol and pairs them together. And if you can prevent a kid from starting to smoke by the time until they're 21, the chances are extremely slim that they'll pick it up after that.
But in terms of tactics that are used to help cut down on the rates of youth smoking, this one sounds as though there's not a lot of research behind it, that either one way or the other, that it makes a lot of difference.
You're right. There isn't as much research on this as there is in some other areas. There is some research on it that shows that it does have an impact. It's not the level of research that we would consider necessary or the Centers for Disease Control would consider necessary to be termed a best practice. We do know what works. There are three or four other things that we think really work considerably better than raising the age. So your question going back to is this something we should be doing in Wisconsin? My answer to that would be perhaps, but I don't think that now is the time. The best practices really are very simple. One is creating smoke-free environments. We've done that very well here in Wisconsin. For the last 3.5 years or so, we've had a very strong smoke-free air law. What that does is twofold. It protects people's health when they're in the business place, the workplace, but it also kind of signals a new norm in standards, a new behavior that smoking isn't the norm, that kids don't look around and see everybody smoking and think that that's what everybody does. So smoke-free environments have a big impact in discouraging teen smoking. Price has a big impact. Wisconsin's tax is that right now, I believe it's the 10th highest in the nation at $2.52. So that means a pack of cigarettes costs anywhere between $6 and $8. And kids who have limited income, many of them will consider that as a factor. They will decide whether they really, that's how they want to spend their money. On the other hand, when we were talking about some of these other products, the little cigars, dissolvable products, snus, things like that, they're taxed at a much lower rate. So they're considerably less expensive, and we do believe that that's why many kids are turning to the little cigars. On top of that, they come in a lot of candy and fruit flavors, strawberry, chocolate, vanilla, and when you add those two things together, they're very appealing to an underage person who's kind of in the experimental stage of life.
Yeah, I want to come back to those in just a second. One of the things I forgot to mention about the legislation in New York City is that in addition to raising the age to 21 to be able to buy this, they also set a minimum price, I think, for a pack of cigarettes at $10.50. And so that was something also that was opposed by a lot of shopkeepers and so forth in the city as well. That price increase, though, that might be something you might find more attractive here in Wisconsin.
Well, and we've always believed that price increases. There is definitely data and evidence to show that price increases do deter youth smoking. I think the formula is for every 10% increase in price, there's a corresponding 7% reduction in smoking, in youth smoking, and a 4% reduction in adult smoking. So we do know that there's a direct correlation with price. That's why it's so important to get these other products, especially the flavored ones, up there into the same kind of price category that cigarettes are.
And let's talk about those other products for a second. I know a lot of us have seen them for sale and so forth. Are they're taxed at a different rate? They're priced at a different rate? I guess I have to say I'm really not familiar with how that all works.
Well, they're both. But when you look at a pack of cigarettes, which is $6 to $8 in Wisconsin, and at least $2.50 in that are taxes right there. And yet when you look at a comparable pack of little cigars, for example, you can buy a package of 20 of those for $2 to $3. I mean, if you're a price-sensitive kid, which one are you going to buy? Because essentially they're the same product. They're virtually identical as cigarettes except for the paper that they're wrapped in. So those little cigars are exploiting a loophole in Wisconsin law. and they're enjoying a very nice price advantage over their counterparts.
And one other thing I forgot to mention, boy, I spend most of my life forgetting to mention things, but one of the other things that this legislation in New York took a look at was the idea of these electronic smoking devices, e-cigarettes or whatever they're called, and those are also included in this. And your stance on those is what?
Our stance on those is there's just not enough research out there to know whether they're valuable. We think that certainly the industry is making unsubstantiated health claims in terms of them being safer as well as them being good cessation devices. We just don't have the data yet. There's more than 250 varieties out there, major brands, and each one has its own unique formula in terms of the chemicals that are in there, the amount of nicotine that they might contain. And there just needs to be more research on them. So I think New York is including them simply for that reason alone, that they're not going to give them a pass until they know a whole lot more about them.
We're talking with Donna Winitsky right now about New York City's decision to raise the tobacco buying age to 21, and we would like to hear what you think. Do you think that 21 years old is where the age should be to buy tobacco products here in Wisconsin, or is the current age of 18 okay? It's been working for a long time in the minds of some people. Maybe we should keep it there. Give us a call. Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. And don't forget you can also post to the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls right after the break. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're talking with Donna Winitsky, the policy director of the American Lung Association in Wisconsin, about New York City's decision to raise the tobacco buying age to 21. And we would like to hear what you think about this proposal. Is this something that could or should fly here in Wisconsin? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And don't forget, you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got some calls lined up. We'll be getting to those in just a second. But before we do that, Donna Winitsky, one of the questions I'd like to ask is about enforcement. You know, we can raise the age if we like. We have a current age of 18. But in terms of enforcing laws on tobacco purchasing, how overall is Wisconsin doing, do you think?
You know, I wish I had that number right at my fingertip, but it varies from county to county. I know there have been some counties that are extremely successful and have their sell and buy rate down in the single digits, and that's where we'd like to see it. I know the federal government requires that illegal sales be maintained at a particular rate. Again, I don't have that number right at my fingertips. I'm sorry. And part of the statewide comprehensive program is that in the local communities, they do go around and do these compliance checks, and they send in 17-year-olds. They're not allowed to lie about their age. They must be truthful. If the clerk says, do you have ID? Oh, no, I forgot it. And they're checked for ID, or they're supposed to be checked for ID, as a matter of fact. And again, as I said, the rates can vary from county to county, from very low up into the double digits, which we certainly don't like to see. So the enforcement mechanism would be pretty much the same. But part of the problem with that is with the funding, the cuts that continue to happen to the statewide tobacco prevention and control program, fewer and fewer of those checks can be done. They used to be done several times a year. Now they might be done once or twice a year in a particular community. And that's, again, the result of having that prevention and cessation program cut repeatedly over the last 10 to 12 years. So that's another one of those proven methods that I was going to discuss, that before you raise the purchase age in Wisconsin, we really need to be funding our tobacco prevention program more fully than what we are doing. We're funding it to the tune of about $5.3 million. The Centers for Disease Control says we should be funding that at 10 times or more than that result. So right now, that's an area that we should be focusing on more than raising the age. Another area that we should be focusing on is making sure that all of the gamut of smoking cessation resources, all of the nicotine replacement therapies, all of the different forms of counseling, all of the proven cessation methods are available for people who want to quit smoking. And again, we're falling a little short on that front. So those are the areas that really need to be addressed before we start looking at things like raising the minimum age to purchase.
Okay, let's find out what listeners have to add to the conversation. Mike joins us, and Mike is in Ashland County. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Same. The reason I do not support raising the age of smoking cigarettes to 18 is very simple. At what point are we going to call these people adults? If they can marry, if they can vote, if they can serve our country, they should be smart enough to be able to decide whether they should smoke or not. And maybe the age of majority should be raised to 21 the way we're going.
So, Mike, do you think that maybe, you know, with the raise in the drinking age, it seems like some people have already, at least in their own mind, answered that question?
What I'm saying is that even the drinking age should not have been raised to 21. I grew up in the days when it was 18 when you could legally drink if you so elected. And it was more of a social thing at the beer bars that we had all had back many years ago. I guess the statement is that if you want to raise the age majority to 21, then let's do it. And then you're an adult at 21 with all the decisions that are required that adults have to do on a daily basis.
Mike,
but don't split it. Go ahead.
No, go finish your thought.
Well, I don't think it gives mixed messages to people. When am I old enough to know what I'm supposed to be doing?
All right, Mike, thanks for the input. And let's go to Joe now. Joe joins us, and he is in Oshkosh. Hi, Joe.
Well, I don't think the age should be raised, but for a completely different reason than Mike was saying. The emphasis should be squarely put on the sellers. And there are compliance checks done, and there are fines issued for that, but there's far too few of that. There's probably because there's not enough resources to do more compliance checks. But the other big thing is that, and this is, I would suggest this as a future show, is take a look at the license that you need to sell cigarettes. Here you have adults coming into a community, being able to sell a product that cannot be used in a safe way. They make thousands and thousands of dollars every year off this product, and it costs them $5 as a license at a minimum, and $100 at a maximum if the county or the city chooses to adopt a state ordinance to sell cigarettes. The licensee should be at least on a par with alcohol, which is, what, now $1,000? Probably more than that. And yet, nobody ever does anything about the license. There's far too much emphasis on the buyers, the purchasers, the kids, and there's not nearly enough emphasis on the people who bring the products into the community and make all the money off of them.
Joe, thanks for your call. Donna Wininski, what about that emphasis that Joe says ought to be placed on sellers as opposed to buyers?
Well, the seller does receive a reprimand and a fine if an illegal sale takes place. But again, I agree with both of these gentlemen. They have very good points. But we know what works. We know that a comprehensive program works. As the last gentleman pointed out, there are fewer checks because we don't have a comprehensive funded program. We know that increasing the price of tobacco products works, and we know that smoke-free environments works. And that's really where we should be focusing our resources in Wisconsin. I wanted to point out that there is a piece of legislation being circulated right now. It's called the Backpack Tobacco Act. And what it does is it raises the tax on all of those other candy and fruit-flavored products that the kids are being so attracted to, and it makes it comparable to cigarettes. So there is no price advantage. And the second thing that bill does is it puts everything behind the counter so that, like cigarettes, kids have to go up to the clerk and they have to ask for the product. That would go a long way in reducing a lot of the underage illegal sales. So I mean, there are things to be said for each of these arguments, and there's a certain amount of research out there that can document the effectiveness of each of these, but those are the four most proven effective means of reducing teen smoking.
So why is it, do you suppose, that in New York City that this age to the raising of the age to 21 is being so overwhelmingly passed? I mean, is this just politics, or do they actually think it's going to make a difference?
Well, I think New York has a lot of those pieces in place. They have the highest cigarette tax. If you actually add up all of the taxes in New York, the city tax, the state tax, I mean, it already costs probably $10. I mean, so when you're talking about having a minimum price of $10, New York City is probably there already between all of the different levels of taxes. So they have that piece in place. They have a comprehensive smoke-free air law. That piece is in place. I don't know what their funding is for their tobacco prevention and control program, so I can't speak to that. But they have a lot of the best practice building blocks in place already, so they are perhaps in a better position to be looking at a little bit more outside of the box policy, such as raising the minimum age to purchase. Every state and every city, for that matter, is in a little different position. I'm just saying that here in Wisconsin, we don't have all of those building blocks in place yet to put us in a position where we should even be talking about raising a minimum age.
Let's go to Tina now. Tina joins us from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. I sort of agree with the first gentleman that went through, Mike, that you can't be, 18 years old, you're either grown and you can make decisions. If you can make decisions, and I'm retired military, to join the military and go and kill people, then you can decide if you choose to drink or smoke. I'm no fan of tobacco. My father died of small cell carcinoma. But I think a big thing would be is pull the subsidies for the growers. Tobacco is a really expensive and finicky crop to grow. And the great state of Virginia and North Carolina suck in a lot of subsidies that support their tobacco farmers, have them grow at free market and sell at free market.
Tina, thanks for the call. And Donna Wininski, I'm not sure what role tobacco subsidies play in all of this. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't know exactly to what extent tobacco subsidies play either. So I'm afraid I am unprepared to answer that particular question.
Let's go back to the Backpack Tobacco Act for a second, which I have to say is kind of a thrill to say.
Tobacco Act.
There you go.
Backpack. Roll off your tongue, doesn't it?
So that's being introduced here in the Wisconsin legislature?
Right. It has circulated through the legislature for co-sponsorship. We're just waiting at this point in time for the leadership in the assembly to assign it a bill number and to direct it to a committee for review. So it's a little bit interim stage right now.
And so as it's being circulated, what sorts of things are you hearing about it?
Well, it's surprising. We were very pleasantly surprised. We thought we might have a little bit of a difficult time in the Assembly Republican caucus because they do have a very anti-tax platform. But they do seem to get that this isn't a tax increase. It's a tax equity proposal. We're not increasing the cigarette tax. We're just eliminating that loophole that these other tobacco products have that make them so much less expensive. If it looks like a cigarette, if it smells like a cigarette, it should be taxed like a cigarette. If it has the same health impact as a cigarette and contains tobacco, it should be taxed like a cigarette.
All right. Well, Donna Wininski, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Donna Wininski is the policy director at the American Lung Association in Wisconsin, and we've been talking about the move in the city of New York to raise the age to buy tobacco to 21.
You can weigh in on that on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Do you like what New York did? Is there something else you think should be done or not done when it comes to tobacco control and prevention? Coming up next, we'll talk with a guest who says that we the people are capable of ending gridlock in the nation's capital. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. I'm here today filling in for Veronica Rickard. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.